If you enjoy this podcast, please like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram and visit our website at lifebetweenthevines.com.
And for me, what I love about winemaking is that you're taking an agricultural commodity and you're turning it into something that invokes such a thought response with people. You know, you and I just met, but we have this common bond of wine, and we could probably sit down with a couple bottles of wine and spend all night together. You know, it's really cool to have something like that to really form bonds with other people.
Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 504. This week we feature Sam Baxter, owner and winemaker at Terra Valentine, Spring Mountain, Napa Valley. Our very first interview with Sam Baxter dates back to November of 2009, and that was podcast number 9. We've done a few more interviews over the years between, so it was good to catch up once again. I visited Sam at the home of Terra Valentine on Spring Mountain in May. While the earth was still scorched from the recent fire, the view from his property was simply breathtaking. Sam makes great wine, and I am a fan. I have no problem admitting it. Why not learn about one more great wine, right? You can also hear Sam on our Vino Lingo segment, defining the term eulogy. We're here on Spring Mountain, one of my favorite places in Napa Valley, and we're here with our old friend Sam Baxter of Terra Valentine. How are you?
I'm good, Ray. Thanks. Good to see you again.
Good to see you as well. Good to see everything going on here. We're going to talk about the space here, which is kind of unique. But most importantly, you did deal with some very severe fires up here, and I just kind of want to get people caught up on the fact that you are in business, you are selling wine, you have a wine club, and there are other things you do.
All in all, we were pretty fortunate with the fires. I make my wine down at a facility in St. Helena, which was unaffected, and I store my wine down in a large warehouse and so all of our case goods. So, you know, our overall operation wasn't severely impacted, unlike some of our neighbors up here on the mountain, which was a pretty tragic event up here for sure.
Very fortunate the wine was off site. That's great.
Absolutely.
Glad to hear that. Coming up in the mountain, a lot has changed here. There was a lot of damage done on the road. The road's in better shape overall. But when you come up to your place, to your space up here, I always say to people, man, you got a view. Sam, you got one damn view, man. It's 245 degrees, basically-ish, if not more. It's beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I didn't really know there was a top of Spring Mountain until I set foot on this property. And it was in early 2015, and I was looking for kind of a future home for Terra Valentine, where we were going to, plant our flag and kind of create a new estate, 2.0. And my wife and I came up here and saw this view. And, I spent my whole life in St. Helena on Spring Mountain, born and raised at the bottom of Spring Mountain Road. And I never really been to the top where you could see in all directions, and including out to the Pacific Ocean. And it really changed my whole perspective on Spring Mountain and sort of the terroir, the climate, what makes it tick up here. And we just fell in love. I mean, I just was blown away by this vista being right at the border between Napa and Sonoma, and be able to look, down into the valley floor in one direction and out to the Pacific Ocean over the Petaluma Gap in the other direction. And I'm continually feeling really lucky to be up here and have landed at this spot.
Yeah, I would call it flipped out.
Yeah.
It's kind of what it is, especially when you just walk out here. You have been in this business for really the better part of your life because of your dad.
Mm-hmm.
Fair to say?
Oh, yeah. I mean, my first jobs were at wineries, working on bottling lines as a kid and, working with my dad then through my teenage years. And, and then starting at Terra Valentine as my first full-time job out of UC Davis. And,
funny.
It's wild. I still have the same email address that I've had. I'm one of the few people that have had the same email address for 23 years.
Wow. Well, I think you're what?
28 years old, right? I
mean, right, yeah.
You do have kind of this eternal youthful look, which I got to give you a lot of credit for.
Well, it's good genetics, I guess, to a certain extent. And, you know, I mean, I kind of try to do what I'm doing with a low-key kind of, I really enjoy what I do. And it's hard work, you know, it's unbelievably hard work and the challenges in this business and in this area. But, you know, I think a lot of it is sort of the frame of reference around it. And I like to have fun and work hard. And I think that hopefully that'll keep me young.
I'm sure it will. I think, well, and that's proven to be with many winemakers, as we can look around and talk about many who have survived well into their 90s.
Mm-hmm.
I think, though, too, the idea of accomplishing something, and I'm not talking about one thing like accomplishing a label, but accomplishing the day's tasks. I think that's a kind of thing that both keeps you driven. And when you go home at night and lay your head on the pillow, you're like, yeah, good, on to the next one, right?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I love having that insurmountable list of tasks, you know, that you'll never get through. And that does drive me. I don't do well when there's not a lot to do. And I think part of that is why, you know, I wanted to take on a project like this property, is because there's never not something to do. And I love that challenge. And yeah, I'm not gonna lie. I mean, there's certain days where I'm like, man, this is crazy. So overwhelming. I'm never gonna get this done, you know, but that's usually for reasons that are more in my head than in actuality. And so you just kind of keep plugging away and come back at it the next day.
So you're the kind of guy, like a number of winemakers I've interviewed, that I see as the real Napa Valley. Your hands are dirty. You get out there and you make the work happen, versus what many people see is the glitz and the glamour. You know, you make great wine, you're really doing it. And I think that just, to me, describes a Napa Valley winemaker.
You know, the whole glitz and glamour part of Napa Valley, you know, I didn't grow up with that. I mean, you know, growing up here, you know, the farmers drove pickup trucks and, you know, you ate at the, you know, the family diner restaurant, you know. So I've always had that kind of perspective here. And I think I've always kind of struggled with the amount of kind of glitz and glamour and fame and fortune that has moved into this area and has changed the business and created that, you know, the competition that isn't really the same as, like, I'm not competing with someone doing exactly what I'm doing. You know, these are kind of whole different types of businesses. That being said, you know, the glitz and glamour has brought in a huge amount of amazing talent and these great restaurants and tourism. And so you kind of have to have a little bit of that in order to have made Napa Valley what it is. We need people coming in that are looking to collect wine and have these amazing experiences and eat great food and experience the Napa lifestyle. But there's something for everybody, you know, and that's what I think I've been able to sort of find my niche and say, hey, I can keep doing what I'm doing and they can keep doing what they're doing and we can coexist. And those people that are coming to visit Napa Valley can do both as well. They can come and go through the, you know, the amazing barrel cellar and see the fancy car collection and the art collection at these beautiful architectural masterpiece wineries. And then they can also come up Spring Mountain Road and you know, hike around a ranch and, you know, enjoy a glass of wine out in nature to a certain extent and feeling the dirt, you know, getting themselves getting their feet a little dirty. And so I really am comfortable with the niche I've found and just love doing what I'm doing.
That's great. Well, as the old saying goes, if you love what you do, you don't work a day in your life.
Ha, ha. Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, and there's days where I hate this, yeah, you know? Yeah. I mean, there's days where I absolutely am like, what am I doing? This is insane. You know, again, those are the days you power forward. And those are the days I typically spend a few hours on my excavator, and I feel a lot better after that.
That's kind of it. Well, it's a therapy thing.
Well, I nicknamed her my therapist. So I'd say, I'm going to go spend a few hours with my therapist. And, you know, I'd clear out some burned out brush. And I'd go, I feel a little bit better now.
Yeah, I could see that. Yeah, that's totally cool. Well, I'm going to go back to the fire just for a minute, mostly because of the space we are in. This is it called a tiny house? Is that right?
This is a legit tiny home, yeah.
Which you can see there are stairs behind him.
Yeah, going up to my office.
Yeah, that's kind of cool, actually.
You can't really stand in the office. You kind of have to hunker for a little bit to get over to the desk. But, once you're sitting in the desk, the view from up there is pretty amazing.
I was just going to say, the view down here, of course, is insane, just being out on the dirt, but going up just that little higher, it's funny how
it feels like being in a cockpit of a 747.
Really?
You're like up there, the full windows around and, at the desk and, kind of central command doing all the work that, the paperwork, the busy work that goes along with this business. But being able to look out, watch the storm coming in. Okay, there's a storm brewing. You can see the cells of, rain kind of moving in from the northwest. And so it's dynamic up here. I mean, there's, in some days it's kind of almost overwhelming how dynamic it is up at the top of a mountain. We got this tiny home here to be our central command office, which is what the house that was up here served prior to it burning down in the glass fire. And it was pretty amazing to be able to be back up here on this property. Just I think it was about 5 months, 4 months post fire, we were able to be back here, running the wine business out of this location again.
That's amazing. Wow. And on top of that, you have an Airstream behind me. If everybody looks behind me, they can see it, as well as this really cool tent. So you have a space here. You have the Airstream in the back. You have this tent, and you're able to conduct business here easy enough, and really in a very unconventional way. And a lot of winemakers say that one of the many reasons they love the business is being able to work outside. Well, you're real outside here.
Yeah, definitely. And there's days where that works really well up here, and then there's days where you wish you had a little more indoor space to spread out.
Sure.
And so it's not a forever plan here. The Airstream is our family kind of bedroom, so it's where we live down in town, just 15 minutes down the hill. But we do a lot of entertaining up here, and so it is not nice after a few bottles of wine, not having to drive down Spring Mountain Road and being able to have a place to sleep. So this is it's really about the experience here. We don't have we're not trying to roll out some crazy hospitality program or tasting room. It's very intimate and private. So it's just a place for us to entertain our family and friends and run our wine business out of. And so that has been working really well temporarily. And we have to keep moving forward, right? We have our use permit to build a winery and taste room. That's the next step, there's been about a year and a half post fire. And I've spent a lot of time clearing the forest and cleaning up. And I feel like just in the last couple months, we're kind of coming over that hill and now moving towards now we can continue to build. Now we can move forward. And it's taken me longer than maybe others. Sherwin Family Vineyards started rebuilding their winery, within a couple of months after
the
fire.
Wow.
And
it's good to hear.
Yeah, I mean, they were just kind of got right at it. But, I didn't have a winery here yet. And so after the fire, needed some time to really digest and figure out what we're going to do. And it kind of, out of 112 acres on this property, about 110 of them burned to various degree. And so it was quite a bit of cleanup and processing and going, okay, what are we going to do with this? And I think we're at a good point now. I mean, it's been a lot of fun to sort of kind of carve out and envision what this place is going to be in the future. That pre-fire, it was much more difficult to visualize. I knew I wanted to have some vineyard over here, but at the time it was, it was a huge forest. And I didn't really know if I had the stomach to take that forest out to convert to vineyards.
That's a lot of work.
It's tough. I mean, it was beautiful forest. Post-fire, when it's gone, I mean, it burned, like blackened forest. Yeah. It's just a little easier to go, okay, well, what's the next step for this, for part of the property? And, the vineyard is going to be incredible. I mean, it's a beautiful soil, the rock structure, the aspect, everything has great potential. And And then there's still a majority, you know, most of the property is going to remain as forest, and we're learning how to sort of to manage that, you know. And I've learned a lot about how to take care of what's left behind where the trees didn't die. You know, yeah. The whole under forest understory burned, but the trees are still alive, or at least most of them. Yeah. And so it's about kind of protecting and managing and preserving that section. And then the part that we need to work with up here between the winery and planting some vineyard is now kind of something we're able to really move forward on.
As you were talking, I did a double take looking out your window because there's about, what, three turkey vultures out there, I'm assuming they are, flying parallel to us.
Yeah, it's a trip. Like, when you look out to Napa Valley, you can, like, see airplanes and helicopters flying lower
than you. Yeah, isn't that crazy? Yeah. I've seen that a couple times when you do a double take.
But, you know, you definitely see a lot of different kind of, well, the wind blows certain directions, right? And so it's all about, you know, the way the wind's blowing and how it would be swirling around. And the way we get it mostly, the fog effect that I like is the waterfall effect. So I'm looking kind of north this direction over Pride Mountain Vineyards to kind of where Bothe State Park is. So it's be the Mill Creek watershed. And the fog will blow up from the Sonoma side, and it'll be kind of nested right up against the west side of the Mayacama. And it'll flow over down into the Bothe State Park. And it'll be this waterfall kind of river of fog rolling down. And
that's got to be cool.
So, yeah, there's just moments like that up here on this property that just every day kind of I'm like, wow, this is just an amazing place to be able to spend time, you know.
Do you get the occasional bear? And I'm sure you get the occasional rattlesnake.
Yeah, definitely. You know, rattlesnakes for sure. The bear, we had a bear up here on the wildlife camera a couple years back. No mountain lions on the cameras. And
I remember, if I'm not mistaken, a couple of years ago, you had one on your doorstep of your house, didn't you?
We did. In St. Helena. Yeah.
Yeah.
In town. And yeah, we had it was like a baby rattlesnake, too.
And those are nasty.
And our neighbor had their toddlers about to run out the door and grab their soccer ball. And this thing was sitting there ready to strike. So that was quite an adventure. Yeah. So, I mean, you know.
It's nature.
It's nature. It's around. And, you know, and up here... you know, post-fire has been really different. You know, there's the flora and the fauna up here has changed for sure. But we see it coming back, you know, starting to bounce back. And, you know, I feel like there's a lot of open space up here. We don't feel like, you know, the mountain lions, coyotes, they're not just all over here.
Yeah,
you know, they have quite a large range. So, because just, you know, west of us, it goes down into, further down into the Sonoma County and Santa Rosa Creek watershed, which does link up with Hood Mountain Regional Park and Sugarloaf State Park. There's quite a bit of open space kind of between where we are down all the way to Highway 12.
Sure. Well, it's not like you're going to get a lot of mountain lions that are come up with a deck of cards saying, yo, Sam, come on, let's play.
True, I know. But you know, you can definitely see some markers. But the other side is I don't have any goats or any food for them here,
no
really. So, you know, we're working towards getting, you know, some livestock up here. But I know that, like, a certain portion of it is just going to be mountain lion food.
Yeah, I get that. Let's go back to you talking about the vineyards. So you have not planted and you're planning on planting. Is that where you're at right now?
Correct, yeah. So we're working on our erosion control plan. To develop, you know, probably around 12 acres of vineyard here, and which out of 112 acres, again, not that much, but for me, it'd be a lot.
It's a lot of work.
It's a lot of work. It's going to be a huge financial undertaking as well, and even once you plant it, then you have to take care of it, right?
So, yes.
You know, and then dealing with the drought issues, the fire issues. There's, you know, those are the days when I start going, wait, why am I doing this again? Like, I don't know, is this a great idea? But then, you know, then there's other days where I'm out there and I'm in the test pit and I'm going, looking at it and the contour, I'm going, this is going to be the best vineyard I'll have worked with in my career.
Nice. Wow.
And that's what drives me forward. I know that. I know that it's going to be the best vineyard I'll have worked with.
Well, and the unique thing about you as a winemaker is that you're a grower, you're a manufacturer, you're a bottler, you're a retailer, you're a wholesaler. You do wear, it's funny, I see the hats hanging on the wall.
Marketing genius?
Marketing genius, of course.
How could I say?
But I mean, it's a pile of work. On top of the fact you're doing physical work, you know, certainly you're in an office, but most of the time you're probably out there getting your hands dirty and in a space that's, you know, fairly wild.
Mm-hmm. So, well, it's, you know, it's all about kind of being able to do all of those different things is what I fell in love with this business in the first place. And, you know, seeing the, you know, the lifestyle around, you know, the growing seasons and the, you know, the, just the, you know, the different things you get to do, you know, from a, you know, black tie event coming back to, you know, putting on the work boots out and just going and slogging out the culverts, you know, there's a little bit of everything. And I enjoy that kind of the diversity in what I get to do. Yeah. And I love it. I mean, I love hard work. I've always loved getting dirty and you know, and it, but it takes, you know, I don't have to do it all. It takes, you know, a good team too. And, you know, very big difference between, you know, what I'm doing now and the old Terra Valentine days is, you know, we had a plan. I think we were up to 14 employees there, and that was great. I loved having a big team, and that my team is pretty lean now, you know, but by outsourcing some of that, that work, I have other people that are helping and are involved, even if they're not on my direct payroll. And that's pretty important to be working with the right kind of partners in all aspects of this.
You got to have the right people. That's mm-hmm. what it's all about in the end. So how many years has it been since you've purchased the brand Terra Valentine?
Yeah, it's been 8 years, believe
wow.
it or not.
Wow.
Yeah. Which, you know, Terra Valentine was in operation at the old Yverdon Winery Estate between 99 and 2014, so about 15 years. And, you know, I worked there the whole time. And so in, I guess, April 2014, purchased the brand when that property was sold to La Jolla. And then about a year and a half later, bought this property. And sometimes it's kind of hard for me to believe that it's already been 8 years, which is, you know, more than half of the time I spent at the old Terra Valentine, which I felt was like the most formative, like it was my career, right? Like it was this huge chunk of time. And now I'm like, wow, like I'm still going and I'm, you know, having even a greater adventure because it's my adventure, you know?
That's a big deal.
It's a big deal.
And with that in mind, let's take a moment to actually talk about the wine.
Yeah.
Certainly you're well known for Cabernet, but you do make some other wines. And what are the other wines? And of course, Cabernet being king in Napa Valley is a big deal, but...
Right. So, I mean, I would say that that still is primarily what we're known for. And I've expanded. I've always made some other single varietals off of Spring Mountain as well. So Cap Franc's always been a grape that has been really close to my palate. Like, I just love the elegance, the floral notes, the, you know, the nuance that Cap Franc brings. And so I've always, since 2008 vintage, we've bottled a Cap Franc separately. As well as a Merlot. Mm. Both those varietals, to me, I just absolutely love. Because there's days when you're not in the mood for a big Cabernet, or you're not having a bone-in ribeye. You know, you're maybe not having any food, and you want something that kind of suits that more mellow kind of mood. And I think that Cap Franc and Merlot, both varietals that do exceptionally well up here on this mountain, and offer kind of a diversion from your typical Cabernet. And so those are two of the important things. I also began making a Petit Syrah from up here on Spring Mountain, starting with the 2015 vintage. And that's a really fun grape. It's funny because it's like, I'm not a Zin guy. I've never made a Zinfandel. I don't drink Zinfandel. And I think Petit Syrah is often kind of in that category of kind of, you know, big jammy, spicy red wines, you know? I mean, and so it wasn't a varietal that I ever really thought I would be working with. But after that Yverdon Vineyard was sold, I began working with a property that was planted by one of my dad's old friends, Dennis Fife, up on Spring Mountain. And so the new owner contacted me because he knew I had worked with that fruit on and off over the years. And so it's been a great source of fruit for me, and very closely involved in the farming there, and have a lot of control. And they have some really cool head-trained Petit Syrah that was planted by Dennis Fife back in around 2000, and they're, you know, cool head-trained vines, and it's just, you know, very different Petit Syrah. It's not that big, jammy, heavy.
Yeah.
It's very dark in color still, but it has an elegance and a finesse that, I mean, I think Spring Mountain brings to most varietals. But Petit Syrah is no exception. It's a really beautiful wine. It's still big, but it's not heavy.
There's something different about it. I'm a huge fan of Petit Syrah.
Yeah, well, I think Petit Syrah is kind of this... wine that's tough to put into a category.
It is.
You know? Yes. And I find that even as, you know, even though I am this marketing genius, like I mentioned, you know, when I'm trying to talk to our customers and wine club members, I'm like talking about the Petite Sirah, I'm like, well, like, how do I fit this into their wine life? You know, if they're a Cab lover or they're a Pinot Noir lover, or, you know, where do you fit in Petite Sirah into your wine lineup? And it is tough. And I struggle that. Is it the first wine I pour? Is it the last wine I pour? And what food do you put it with? And so basically I kind of leave it up to people to decide. Like, if you like this, trust me, you'll fit it into your life. And if it's not for you, then that's cool too.
Yeah, but I see that. That would be a tough call where you pour it. Interesting. It almost have to be its own separate pouring with a couple other wines, but not that I'm telling you anything.
Right. So. But you know, so Big Mountain Reds, that's sort of what we do. And in addition to that, I've also been working with Pinot Noir from out in the Fort Ross, Seaview AVA, from a vineyard out there on right on the kind of the coastal side of the ridge there, but higher up in elevation, and since 2008. And so I've always really loved, Mountain Pinot Noir from Fort Ross as well. And so I make that under the Fortel label, and it's really one of the key parts of our lineup, because again, not everybody wants a big cab all the time. So the Pinot Noir is a big part of what we do.
Sure, and it's good that you do it.
Yeah, you gotta have the lineup, right?
So you are doing a white though.
Yeah, so I do make a Sauvignon Blanc from Kick Ranch, and just a small amount. And it's really, like, I do love having the Sauvignon Blanc around.
Sure.
I think it's a great varietal.
It is great.
And I also make a rosé from Petite Sirah. So that's something that, you know, rosés are tricky. You know, they run the gamut. Some are really contrived. Some are super heavy. I mean, and it's not Provence. Like, we haven't been able to perfect the rosé like they have in southern France. But I do take this Petite Sirah, whole cluster Petite Sirah, from a section of the vineyard that got a little more shade and really, you know, never ripened the way I felt it should. Mm. And so I decided to take that, it's only a couple tons of fruit, and harvest it at, you know, 21.5, 22 bricks, and direct to press, whole cluster, and make a rosé out of it. But actually, it's delicious. It's really good. It's very light in color. But has this beautiful, really pure, like, kind of strawberry, watermelon flavors, great acidity, and it's, you know, 12% alcohol, so it is one that you can, you know, have a bottle with lunch and survive the afternoon.
But it'd be interesting to try a Petite Sirah like that. Distribution-wise, I still see your wines in stores, and are you in all 50 states? Where are you distributed?
No, you know, we kind of restructured our distribution post-pandemic, some intentionally and some unintentionally. Some of our biggest markets historically have been along the East Coast, and the state of Florida was always a great market for us. But they were like my brand manager there. We were a big distributor and had done well for us over the years. But they said, hey, look, you know, we need help out here. We need you out here four times a year. And I looked at that, and I looked at the cases I'm selling there, and I looked at, you know, my kids' sports schedule and the work I have to do here at this ranch. And I thought, that's not how I want to spend my time.
Yeah.
And then also, you know, our East Coast, Upper East Coast and New York distributor, they, through the pandemic, had to really chop down their on-premise wine division. And so they, restructured again, and they said, hey, we just don't want to, we can't invest in the manpower to support small brands like yours. We need to focus on our bigger import brands. And so we lost a few states with that transition as well. And in a way, it's been really beneficial, because then the markets that have stuck with us, and where we've had long broker relationships, have thrived.
As I say, I see it in stores, and in one particular store in Milwaukee, and when I see it, I always smile, because it's like, yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, no, we opened up, I guess it's been in the last year or so, started up with a new distributor in Wisconsin, and they've been great. I found that, you know, by kind of realigning and our small brand with you know, more small to medium-sized distributors has really been a much better match than trying to fight for attention from the large distributors.
About how many cases are you doing now?
So we're only about 3,000 cases a year. So it's pretty small. I mean, it's, you know, it's not tiny, but it's pretty small.
It's what a lot of our listeners seek out. So this is my favorite question to ask winemakers, and I don't think I've ever pitched you this question. So what's the one question you've never been asked with all the media you've done that you would like to be asked?
Well, I think it's the question you just asked.
You're not getting that bad.
Yeah, no, I know. That's an easy cough out, right?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you're right. I've talked to, you know, a lot of people over the years, and you know, I get asked a lot of questions I wish that I didn't get asked. I guess, you know, for me, like, I really love talking about the creative process, you know, and I think that's it's sometimes hard to kind of to draw out. You know, I don't get asked often, you know, about like when I'm blending wines, like the process that I go through when I'm sitting there, like what's going through my head as I'm tasting through, you know, with 20 samples on the table, like how do I really go, what's my process of making a blend? And I think that's really, that's like the thumbprint of a winemaker, you know, is that process. That's when the rubber hits the road. That's when, you know, I make these decisions that, you know, six people sitting around the table might make a different decision than I would.
That's a complicated process, and I've talked to a lot of winemakers about it. I mean, do you have a specific method, or does it vary from vintage to vintage? Or?
Yeah, I have a technique that I use that it's maybe kind of started somewhat, you know, organically, but it's a mindset too. You know, it's really like it's a process, you know. I feel like it's the time when I feel most like a pro athlete or something, where you like, you know, they have a routine, they have to get in the zone, right? Yeah. Where most of the part of the wine process is not that serious, right? Like you can, you know, out in the vineyard, just, you know, you're go, oh, let's do this or that, or you're in the winery doing hard labor or spraying out a tank or whatever. But, you know, when you're sitting down, like laying out, it has to be quiet. I don't like having music on. I don't like people around. I don't, you know, I used to, you know, do a lot of kind of blending by committee and having people working together. But then it was it was very helpful, especially as I was developing my palate and developing this process. But as later in my career, also as my team diminished and it fell more onto me, I realized I really, really loved having just empty house or room and all the things, and I can just kind of do what I need to do. And so that's for me, that's part of it. I mean, then there's, you know, the whole process with each wine and how I'm tackling that, that gets even more detailed and involved. But
well, it is highly personalized.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, most importantly today, for our listeners who would like to learn about Terra Valentine, how they can get a hold of it or learn about you on the web, what's your website?
It's terravalentine.com. It's woefully not updated, but it's one of those projects. It's on the list, right? You know, we'll get there. You can follow us on Instagram at Terra Valentine Wine. You can give us a call. You know, we're here. Rebecca, Director of Sales and Marketing, is always around, myself, and we're a small but mighty team. And if you call, most likely you'll get an answer from me.
And I've said this before, how cool to be able to talk to the winemaker.
Yeah, I love that too. I love when people call and they're like, hey, I got a question about this or that. And even if I'm out on the tractor or whatever, I'd love to chat. And we love to hear from our customers. You know, that's a big part of what we do, because, you know, we can't see everybody in person. So we get to interact, talk on the phone. It's a great way to do it.
It's a people business. It's mm-hmm. how it works. Sam, awfully, awfully, awfully good seeing you after so long. Thanks very much for taking the time today.
Ray, thanks for making your way up Spring Mountain to say hello. Great seeing you.
Learn more by visiting terravalentine.com. Thanks for listening. Subscribe to the podcast at lifebetweenthevines.com or sign up to our YouTube channel. You can also follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Life Between the Vines comes to you from Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Our host is Kay Pascoff. Our web geek is Dan Gisha. Original music by Ray Pfister. Copyright 2022.